Blog Talk Radio.
If you find yourself in trouble, count on me, my friend. I'll get right up in trouble's face. You won't see him again. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up, shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, American.
Welcome to another exciting show with Southern Sense on Blog Talk Radio. So turn up the volume and enter our chat room, or grab your phones, call in, and join the conversation. Help us to restore the republic to this country and inspire the majority to be silent no longer.
Well, look me straight in the eye. Tell me what you see. I'll tell the truth every time. Yes, you can count on me. I've got the backbone, American. I've got the heart, American. I've got the will, American. Will you stand up, don't sit down? Stand up, don't back down. Stand up and shout it out. Stand up, let's make it loud. American, 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 American.
Good afternoon to another exciting adventure here on Southern Sense. I am, of course, the host with the mostest, the radio chick, Annie, along with my cool, suave, sophisticated, cool Mike. Good afternoon, Mikey.
Good afternoon, Annie. It is great to be here as we are about to start an honoring holiday weekend. It is, as always, a pleasure and an honor. I know that our days of doing a show together are numbered because you're going to move on to bigger and better things, whether it's ABC, NBC, Fox News, or Congress.
Anything but a commie broadcast, nothing but communist broadcast, I think not. The Clinton News Network, I don't think so. I like it here.
Well, I like it here, too. And hopefully we'll have a great show. But in the meantime, just a quick reminder to everybody that our star extraordinaire, Annie Ubilis, has so many ways of communicating with each other. There's no excuse for not listening to Southern Sense. As a matter of fact, I can't verify this, but Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan sent us emails that they were listening to the show from six feet down under. Yes. But anyway, I'm not even going to start to mention, other than Facebook and Twitter, I get lost at all the things Annie and her hip crowd has reached out to network for this awesome show. And also
me, myself, and I.
Yeah, and also our last show was number 4 for quite a while on the popular. So thank you, everybody.
I'm glad to keep track of this. I never look at it. I'm glad someone's looking at it.
Well, because BTR upgraded and they've done such a great job of making things so simple and less complicated, and it's so more efficient now. You have to click on like 600 million things, and if you remember them all, you can get there. But each time, it's like, wait a minute, did I click this one the last time or that one? No.
I do have to let people know that Stitcher. I keep on saying Stitcher. It's Stitcher. And they can find a link on our southernsense.webs.com. There's a link to it. But Stitcher now has a car app. So if you take your phone and you mount it on your whatever holder you have, you just go to the Stitcher app, be in Southern Sense when you're in Stitcher, and you can listen to the show as you're driving. So we are now available in everyone's cars.
Yes, and of the new models as well, it automatically includes Stitcher.
Yeah,
if your phone
goes through the car, all you have to do is hit the Stitcher app, key in the show Southern Sense, and we are on the very top. That's the first show that pops up when you key in Southern Sense. You don't have to look for us. We're there. So join us.
My brother has a 2013 Corvette, and when you were on the satellite radio, I couldn't find it on the computer. So in his car, he had it and just placed the cell phone right next to the speaker so I could listen to our host extraordinaire. And he said something like, what is this Breaker thing or Stitcher, whatever, which one? I think it was Stitcher, whatever. But I was just like, dang, that is amazing. And think of 50 years from now. I mean, people will be like, man, you guys only had AM, FM? Times change. But anyway, let's rock and roll for this awesome
show. Yeah, we got to move along.
I love your dedication. I looked at it yesterday. Very good dedication. Try not to break down again, Annie. Three words into the dedication. Try to last till the end this time, huh?
All right. We are in a bit of a time constraint because our guest will be calling exactly quarter after the hour, and we can only have him for 15 minutes because he is on to the airport. I'm wondering if maybe we should delay the dedication until after our guest calls in because we have 7 minutes before he calls.
Well, that's up to you. There is an issue Andrea Shea King posted on Facebook, and I'm going to try during the show, after our guest is gone, to try to get it into a file so we can upload it, where Ted Cruz outright just said on the floor he does not trust the Republicans, he does not trust the Democrats, and he points out when his 5-year-old daughter was born, the debt ceiling was $10 trillion. She's 5 yesterday, it's now $17 trillion. I think to myself, talk about spending money. I mean, I'm bad with money. That's my own money, but it's my own money. Lord have mercy. That's going to be a great issue. I mean, he said he does not trust them. Whoa.
No, I don't blame him. And the OMB, the Office of Budget and Management, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I have the print somewhere in my stack of stuff to scan into my desk. But when I read it through, the OMB has no idea. Listen carefully. They cannot even fathom how many federal agencies currently exist. Not only do they not know how many agencies, they don't even know what these agencies do. So here is our federal budget blossoming. And with each executive order that is signed, it grows even larger and larger. And with each piece of pissant legislation that gets passed, whether it's Obamacare or gun control or amnesty for illegal aliens, more and more bureaucracy gets added layers. We have a government where no one knows what anyone else does. You've got people walking around with clipboards and pens and pads just scribbling into air to make it look like they're doing something and getting a paycheck courtesy of the suckers who are called the American taxpayer.
Damn, you go again, Annie. That's true. What's it say about branches of the government that don't even know your other branches? For example, you have corporations such as McDonald's. McDonald's owns other subsidiaries. They know all of it. I mean, the federal government has just ballooned to a point where it's – who does trust them? I mean
– Now, imagine owning a business. And in a business, you know, you're trying to make a profit. That's the idea. That's the capitalist idea. You want to make a profit so you have an income, a nice home, a way to raise your family, and to good schools and good vacations, you make a good life. And that's the idea. And you want to hire people so that you can help them make their life a good life, but you still want to make money and make a good profit and satisfy your customers. You're going to know where every penny goes. And if money starts appearing, you're going to stop, call your accountant over, and, hey, listen, my profit margin isn't meet what it should be. You know, do an audit. Well, this is what we need to do, the federal government. We've got to audit the government, find out where everything is. And I do believe my guest here, he caught in the middle of a rant. Let me bring him aboard. Well, good afternoon, Niger Innes.
Hello there.
Hello. Yeah, hi there. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
You caught me in the middle of a rant. I was complaining about the burgeoning government.
No, you go right ahead. Continue.
Niger, since we only got you for a few minutes, this is cool, Mike. Quick question. What? Always, Annie and I always appreciate your honesty. Like it or not like it, this is how it is, and this is what's on the table when you have Niger in us. Niger, at what point will people in the black community realize that Maxine Waters and just all these people are just manipulating and using a community at whole for their own individual gain?
I think actually a lot of black people realize that and have realized it for a long time. I just think that unfortunately we as a conservative movement and the Republican Party at large has not given these folk a viable alternative. Let me change that. Actually, that's not true. They have not given what these people perceive as a viable alternative. And sometimes you have a situation where it's even worse, where you have a Republican Party. I mean, a lot of minority communities are in central cities. You know, they're in urban districts. And the Republican Party sometimes, in, like, for example, in my home city of New York City, outside of the exceptions of Rudy Giuliani and, you know, the revolutionary 8 years that he was in office, the Republican Party of New York City is a basket case. It was a basket case before Rudy Giuliani. It is a basket case after Rudy Giuliani. Michael Bloomberg used it as if he were, let's say, a John, and they were something else. Okay? How's that for a little honesty? And unfortunately, that feebleness of a lot of urban Republican parties or blue state Republican parties trickled all the way down to these black communities and black districts. So what you essentially have then is you have a one-party dictatorship in these urban centers all across the country. But I think things are changing. Let me give you, you know, I said some pretty tough things here, and I paint a pretty grim picture, but let me give you a silver lining or a little bit of hope. In the last election cycle, And actually, this is pretty instructive because we did not do this through the Republican Party. We did, you know, in addition to my work at the Congress for Racial Equality, I also work with theteaparty.net. That's theteaparty.net. And what we did was extraordinary in the last, in this special election that just occurred several weeks ago. In Jesse Jackson's district, Illinois 2, of course, we all know that Michael Bloomberg put in, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, it's a strong Democratic district. Republicans barely, you know, get more than 10% of the vote ever in that district. Obviously, it was Jesse Jackson's district. You know, the only question that people had was who's going to win the Democratic primary, because whoever wins the Democratic primary will obviously be the next congressperson. Well, we had an extraordinary grassroots candidate that we found and that won the Republican primary. His name was Paul McKinley. And we reached out to him, gave him a little bit of support. I shouldn't say we reach out to him directly, but reach out certainly to folk that were supportive of him in the community. And we gave some consultation, gave some resources to those people that were supportive of his candidacy in the community. And the thing is, we did this really at the last minute. I mean, we did this maybe 3 weeks out before the election. And even though this poor candidate was outspent some 800-1 by the Democratic Union Dick Daley machine in Chicago, we were able to garner 23% of the vote in that district with, you know, minimal effort and with a focus finding a good candidate, a minimal effort, and he didn't try to act like a Democrat light. He didn't try to act like a liberal with a Republican lapel pin on. He acted like a Second Amendment-loving, conservative, small, limited government Republican that he is. And we were able to garner in this deep blue district, we were able to garner 23% of the vote, able to get the highest percentage for a Republican in that district in nearly 40 years. So it's not impossible. It can be done. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm going to say the same thing. I agree with you because I find when I sit down and I start talking to people, it doesn't matter what their race or color is, when you just sit down and have a one-on-one friendly conversation, you find them starting to think the same way you are. I had a young lady, she had been black, worked for Enterprise, came to the house because I was renting a car, and I was talking to her, and she's 1 year out of high school, and I started talking about the fair tax because something came on the radio. And she goes, oh, they're just an income tax. It's going to be. She says, no, do you understand? And I started to explain it to her and how it broke down and how someone in her income bracket would probably end up having additional money at the end of the month because it's to help meet all the new sales taxes. Because you mean I'm actually going to pay less, but they're telling me they're making me think I'm going to be paying more? And I said, yes. She goes, whose idea was this? And I said, conservatives. She goes, oh, I didn't know you guys did that. You have to get out there and talk to them.
That is a very, very important point. And you cannot see a lot of, you know, I don't speak racially because I think that, you know, you have the other side, the Democrats that are racially obsessed and that use race and division as a weapon of political combat. So I try not to engage in that kind of conversation, but here it is relevant. Your spirit and your courageousness is what is needed among conservatives. We have to go into those communities. We have to, regardless of what we think the return is going to be, regardless of what we believe the reception is going to be, we have to boldly, bravely go into every one of these communities, every barrio, every ghetto, every street corner, and engage in intellectual hand-to-hand combat with the liberals. And know if it is a black community, it would be nice if you've got a black conservative or black constitutionalist, free market, small government conservative. But if you don't have one, you can't wait for one. You go in there yourself if you happen to be white. You go in there yourself if you happen to be black and you're going into a Latino community and you think you should wait for the perfect Latino candidate. No. We have to do what the socialists have done for nearly 100 years, maybe longer, which is engage these communities, make contact with these communities, let them know boldly our ideas. Do not patronize these folks. Do not sell out your own principles, because they will read through that insincerity and you will lose. But if you go in there and you boldly preach the free market, small government, conservative principles, then you may not win all of them, but you'll win some, and you'll win all of their respect.
That's the truth. That is the truth. Amen. I know you're heading to the airport. Where are you going today?
I am actually currently in Washington, D.C., and I am so thrilled to be leaving and headed back to my adopted home of Las Vegas, Nevada.
All right. Now, I remember you when you were running your dad's campaign against David Dinkins. because yes. I entered NYPD under Dinkins and I retired under Giuliani. So those are all years I remember very vividly. What made you come to
years.
The right side?
Well, you know, I'm, you make reference to that, and it's funny that you make reference to that right after, and I had no idea who I was talking to here, but that's how ironic it is that I brought up Rudy Giuliani and you know, the one shining moment of the New York City Republican Party over the last almost 50 years, it seems. You know, my father and I are generationally conservative, you know, even if we're not Republican, because as you know, he ran as a Democrat, you know, and, mm-hmm. and he ran even though, again, very similar parallels to the race I was just talking about in Illinois, too, because obviously in a very Democratic city, he ran in a Democratic primary and was able to get 26% of the vote in a Democratic primary, win a borough, you know, win a number of election districts in liberal New York City, and he did it as a conservative Democrat. So we are generationally, you know, I'm a conservative Republican. I kid him and tell him that's called political evolution. I think part of what makes people do what they do and operate politically the way they do is their life experience. And he came from first of all, he came as an immigrant. He's from the Caribbean. And he came to the country with certain fundamental principles and values. And he lived in Harlem. And, you know, as in any other community, you have all kinds of types. And he just tended to gravitate towards those in Harlem. And then when he went to City University of New York, when it was an outstanding school before political correctness, he gravitated those who had a conservative point of view, conservative values. He was deeply suspicious of John F. Kennedy, who these days actually would be a conservative. But back then, he was even suspicious of John F. Kennedy because of some of the liberal policies of the Democratic Party. So we've been conservative for quite a long time. And even though I had a little rebellious flirtation when I was in high school with Jesse Jackson's candidacy for president, I quickly woke up when I read Jesse Jackson's platform and realized that as great of a speech maker as he might have been, his policies were wrong for Black America, and they were wrong for America at large, as was that ideology.
Yeah, I always thought of your father similar to Ed Koch, but without the bombastic personality. Is that a compliment?
Well, I tell you this, I've had the opportunity to meet Ed Koch. I consider when he was alive, I consider him a friend, and I think that there is certainly a lot of similarity in the political journey that my father went on and that Ed Koch went on as well. My father was never, you know, it's so funny. My father gets labeled a neoconservative. And, you know, obviously neoconservatives meaning a new conservative, you know, and the classic neoconservative is someone that was a liberal in the 40s and 50s, but then as the Democratic Party and liberalism really got tainted by socialism and progressivism, felt that, you know, what they had known as liberalism, which was a strong national defense and decency, and if there's any degree of liberalism, it's maybe in the area of something like civil rights. That liberalism of the 40s and 50s had been greatly tarnished by the radicalism of the socialists and these types. So these folks started to go on a journey that led them to actually becoming conservative, a lot more conservative than they had been. My father really never went on that kind of journey. His journey was a little bit different. He obviously, America and New York City in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, early 60s, as he was growing up and as he was just really getting into public life, America and New York City was, you know, quite different for Black Americans then than it was than it is today. And even though he was conservative in many of his values even back then, I think the degree of optimism that he has for America today and that he's had for America for the last 30 years, he did not have that optimism back then. He thought that the racial situation was intangible back then, and he thought that this friction that existed between Black Americans and white Americans was not going to go away. So a lot of his conservative prescriptions for dealing with that phenomenon back then, you know, that would radically change over the years because his vision of America would change, and the optimism, or let me put it differently, the pessimism that he had back then would go through an evolution and become a gung-ho optimism about the country and about race relations.
Now, I'm going to ask, it may sound a little weird because, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s. I was a cop in New York in the 80s into the 90s. And, I mean, I've been through it all, the riots on Eastern Parkway, the First World Trade Center. I've seen something, but I don't know if anyone else is noticing it. You know, the youth today in the schools are being taught an aggressive thing. But once they get out and reality hits, they're starting to take, once they go into like college or something like that, they're starting to back off and say, wait a minute, you're not teaching me the right stuff. I'm finding a lot of more young kids are doing this. And then those that have been entrenched in a liberal mindset are starting to step back and say, wait a minute, something doesn't smell right here. And I'm finding a lot of people are starting to listen to our message.
Well, you know something, that you say that, and now you really have me thinking, because if you had said this to me a month and a half ago, I would have been shocked, and I might have even argued back and said, I think you must be smoking something, because there's no way that that's the case. Our children are being poisoned in the schools, and then when they go off to college, the poison is the concentration of poison has been doubled or quadrupled. But I had an experience that gives me hope and that lets me know that you're probably right. There's something going on out there. I spoke at – I was part of a debate with you know, my father, of course, is an ideological and personal hero of mine. Well, another ideological and personal hero of mine. I had the honor of being on the same stage with him at Delaware State University, which is a Black college in Delaware. And it was me and the person I'm speaking of that I was on the stage with was Dr. Robert Wilson. Woodson of the National Center for Neighborhood Enterprise, longtime conservative, real close colleague of Jack Kemp when he was alive, and a real close friend and colleague and partner in a lot of conservative ventures and conservative outreach ventures in the African American community. And Bob Woodson and I were against the entire diversity team, diversity staff, which is kind of ironic considering that it was an all-Black school, or at least historically all-Black school. There were some whites that attended as well. But it was me and Bob versus the entire diversity staff. I mean, Africana studies and all the rest. You know, the usual suspects.
Mm-hmm.
So we were debating, and they started the debate, and they just went through the tired, tried litany of slavery and racism and oppression and we need to have affirmative action today because of slavery and what happened here, and racism is still exists. In fact, a fellow black professor just got arrested, and blah, 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 blah. You guys could probably write the script. So predictable because it's the talking points that they all use. Well, Bob Woodson and I got up, and, you know, first thing I said is, in my best post-Civil War African-American vernacular, said, I thought Mr. Lincoln Dunn said we's free. And, the whole black audience cracked, laughed, backed up laughing. And then I went into my critique and said, you know, look, if you want to believe that you are as much a slave or you are suffering from racism to the same degree that your great-grandparents or grandparents did or maybe even parents did, then you're fooling yourself. Not only are you delusional, but you're quite frankly offensive. And you're not offending me. You're offending them, and you're offending the real pain, the real situations that they went through, and you are undermining it. I will not put that chip on your shoulder because you don't deserve it, you didn't earn it, and you shouldn't have it. That's one point. Point number two is you are in a competitive environment. You're in an environment where not only the country more diverse, but you're in an environment where the more racially diverse, it's not just a black and white country. You've got Latinos, you've got Asians from all over the country, from all over the world that are here. Within the black community, there's even diversity. You have blacks that come here from Africa. You have blacks that come here from the Caribbean. You have blacks that come here from Central and South America. So if you want to walk around like you are being oppressed and the man is on your back and you can't get anything accomplished because you are black, you will lose. You will be and you are a loser. You should not, and any professor, any individual that tries to preach that nonsense to you, you let it come in one ear and right out the other. And Bob, you know, said pretty much the same kind of message, and we got a standing ovation from those kids. And it was a phenomenal wake-up call to me that obviously, and what you're saying, obviously something is going on out there that, you know, very similar to, you know, I guess the way Barack Obama would dream about the Arab Spring, that there is inner city spring, you know, that is springing up within our communities all across the country, particularly among the young that are, you know, that are seeing through these generationally socialist pessimists out there that are preaching racism and preaching oppression and consequently coming up with the same old answers that have failed for problems that are still vexing the black community.
You know, and I give it actually a lot of kudos to the new modes of communication because just before Mark Sanford won his election, I was up in Somerville, and I did expect this. I just got yanked up and said, you know, I want you to introduce him. It was Amy Kramer from Tea Party Express. She just said, go.
Mm-hmm.
So I go forward and introduce, and I'm doing my little spiel, and I says, you know, every one of you that shows up at the rally, you're going to bring 17 people to the polls because you're going to go home and you're going to talk to your friends. You're going to talk to your neighbors. You're going to get on the internet. You're going to get on the telephone because if you were here, 17 more people vote that would not have voted yesterday. I think that is what is happening. The new mode of communication, internet, texting, telephone, I don't know, bird calls. People are out there. But I don't think the progressives realize what a virus they started because they used it to get Clinton and Obama elected. We have learned. Now we're using it to take it back.
I agree. And I think that, you know, again, circling back to how we started this conversation, I think, look, Obama is a phenomenon. not only did his team master the technology and improve upon it, but he took that piece and component along with his own community organizing background, and he merged the two into a formidable operation. In addition to that, of course, he had a disgustingly loyal media, establishment liberal media, that protected him like they were the Praetorian Guard and he was a Roman emperor. And then, of course, you have the race factor and the historic nature of his candidacy, and you almost have a perfect storm. And certainly, you know, you have a perfect storm within the United States generally, and within the black community, you have a perfect storm followed by a perfect storm. You know, so it was going to be pretty difficult for Republicans to get traction during the Obama years, and certainly when he was actually up for election or re-election. Having said that, he's leaving the scene, you know, right? Or as one gentleman said when they were talking about Lincoln, when he had passed on to heaven, he said, now he belongs to the ages. Well, kind of in a certain sense, at least politically speaking, in terms of his own political candidacy, Barack Obama has passed into the ages. Now he belongs to the ages. Now he belongs to the history books. And that gives us, conservatives, an extraordinary opportunity to reach into black and brown communities in ways that we never have before and to ask certain fundamental questions, which is, look, we applaud. It's a wonderful moment. I don't care if you're Republican, Democrat, black, white, Latino, Asian. The fact that this country, that this civilization had elected someone who 50 years ago might have had to ride the back of a bus because of his skin color is extraordinary and is a wonderful moment in history for all of us. But having said that, after 8 years of this historic figure, how are your lives? Are you better off? Is the black employment rate gone up significantly? Is the black unemployment rate gone down? How about the black family? How's that doing? You know, how about black murders, black on black crime? How are we doing there? You know, you can start having an open analysis. In fact, part of the reason I think we were so successful in Illinois too was because we raised the question of the killing fields that Barack Obama's home has become. You know, the fact that you've got more blacks killing blacks and browns killing browns and blacks killing browns and browns killing blacks in the streets of Chicago than you have in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, and when we start asking, getting into these communities with our conservative message, with our conservative vision, and start asking the classic Ronald Reagan question, are you better off? After this wonderful historic event of electing the first black president, I think you're going to be surprised at the results.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because I had a conversation with someone who's trying to put together a Tea Party movie, and it's being done by a liberal, and he's claiming he's going to be unbiased, but we'll wait and see. And I got a discussion with him, and he's saying, well, you're responsible for the urban warfare in Detroit, and you're responsible for it in Chicago. And I said, wait a minute, back up here. I said, who's been in charge of Detroit and Chicago for the last several decades? It has not been Republicans or conservatives. It has been Democrats. It is members of the Black Caucus that have been representing you. Why aren't you asking them this question? What you should be asking us is, yes, do we want to come in and help you? Yes. What would we do? And I went down law enforcement in schools and community outreaches and medical clinics that are either free or discounted. And I went down the litany and I thought literacy training, mentoring. We're here. We've been saying we want to come in and help. Let us come. Let us sit down at the table and have an open, honest conversation. And let's see who gets the city to revive better. You've already tried several decades this way. Why don't you let us in and try a couple of decades this way and see if we can swing it all the way back? You know what he said? sent me a very, very lovely note and a thank you. And he goes, you know, I never thought of it that way.
Good for
and that's
you.
What we have to do.
Good for you. You, the way you talk about making sure you bring 17 people with you to the polls, tell 17 people that story and tell them they need to engage to the same degree with the same passion and the same courage to not have your knees buckle when you get pushed back. And we will be successful. You know, I say to folks, you know, yes, we got to find minority candidates. Yeah, we got to find minority messengers. But the message cannot wait for that. We have to do an inside-outside game. Yes, we need to be looking for candidates that are a reflection of those communities. Yes, we need to find messengers that are a reflection of those communities. But the fight is too overwhelming. The task is too difficult for us to wait. We have to start now. And if it means that you happen to be white and you go into these communities and you start preaching the gospel of conservatism and small, limited government, then so be it. And you will be surprised at the results that you get. Unfortunately, guys, that's got to be the last word for me because I've got to depart. But thank you so much for your time, and I'll be sure to come on your show again when I have a little bit more time.
Wait a minute. Before Niger bounces, 60 more seconds, Niger, real quick. Why was your father so successful in the 80s era as a Democrat where it was so – why was he so ridiculously he would not be influenced by the message when it seemed like 100% of the Democrats were being influenced? He really seemed to be the first of the kiss my ass type.
Well, you know, I think because before political party mattered, what mattered to my father were his principles. You know, what mattered to him were his principles that would lead to particular prescriptions and solutions for problems that existed. And, you know, even though he was a registered Democrat, certainly when he ran for mayor against Dinkins, I think if he, you know, had to classify himself, it would have been as a political independent. And more than that, he also knew that the most vicious wars and the most vicious institutions, or let me put it differently, that the most intransigent institutions that he would often be at odds with and that he would often have to fight against, like the teachers' unions, were liberal bastions and liberal politicians and liberal democratic entities that would fight him and would fight to keep the status quo, fight to keep their constituents, black constituents, brown constituents, exactly in the place that they had found them in. And, you know, he fought back against it. You know, he knew that the harangue of racism, you know, of the Sharptons and these other types was nothing more than a distraction. A distraction. It was the bread and circus, the modern day bread and circus. It was entertainment to distract those from actually looking at problems and looking at those who had the power to solve those problems and do something about those problems, but kept the status quo intact. And so I think it was very easy for him to not drink the Kool-Aid.
I think
thank you so much, Niger.
You have a safe trip home, and thank you so much. And, yes, I'll talk to Alicia and get you back on here.
Sounds like a plan. You guys have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. God bless our soldiers that have sacrificed for this great country.
Amen.
Absolutely.
To that.
Amen. Thank you so much, Niger. Man, what a fantastic guest, Niger Innes of the Congress of Racial Equality. Yeah, this is what I like. I mean, we're able to get good quality things like this, and it takes your breath away when you speak to someone of like gentleman.
Yeah, well, especially in a day and age where politically all you're seeing is manipulation, somebody who you're not going to manipulate. somebody who at the word go can smell whether or not you're telling the truth or lying. That's always
Yeah, the BS meter is up, and that's what we need to do. We've got to ratchet it up, the BS meter. You know me, I'm a troublemaker. I posted a question up on LinkedIn the other day asking if the Republicans or the conservatives need to help the Republicans to repackage message. Overwhelmingly, every last person, and I mean there must be dozens of responses, have said, we've got to bring the party back to the conservative issues, the conservative values, because these rhinos are screwing everything up. We've got to kick them out and take back control of the party and bring us back to where we are. Because what are we are? What are we for? Less government. We want less intrusion. We don't want to be stuck in that cycle of poverty that they want everyone else to be stuck in. To be, you know, forever on your life living off of the government tit and never advancing anywhere in your life. Living a doldrum life. So what's next? Unwanted pregnancies, alcoholism, drug addiction. Am I describing certain inner cities where they have them tamped down? We want to go in there and bring them up and say, hey, listen, they're real. There is salvation. But it's got to start with you wanting it first, and then we're here to help you find it. That's the message.
Yeah, you know, Annie, you're in South Carolina. And here's another example of exactly what you just said. Based on being in South Carolina, would you say what you hear about Michigan, that Michigan is a booming state with lots of money?
According to the TV commercials, I'd say yes. That's according to the TV commercials. If anyone believes the TV commercials, but then again, South Carolina is no picnic, because I can take you, just a couple blocks over. And if I were to show you the trailer parks, trailer upon trailer upon trailer, you know, we have the high-rise, you know, city thing, but you've got these trailers that probably cost me just a few thousand dollars, and you've got 15, 20 people living in them. If I showed you the poverty that sits back there, and these are people on that welfare tit, and try to get them to say, all right, you want help. You dropped out of school. All right, let's mentor you with literacy. Let's see if we can help you get job skill, and we'll work with you to try to get a job. You know, you're an unwed mother. All right, let's see. We can take you to the medical clinic, and you can always be a checkup for you and your baby. But people don't want to do it because they sit back and they get a government check, and they think that's all. And you know what? If anyone thinks I'm being prejudiced, do you know the race that gets the highest number of these welfare benefits? Whites. Unwed white mothers. So it's not a racial thing, guys. Once you get stuck in that welfare cycle, unless you want to get out of it, you're not going to get out of it. And if I've tried to help friends out, I've tried several times. It's all right, fine, let me give you a hand. You know, you've got no food in the refrigerator here. I'm going to put some food in the refrigerator. But tomorrow we'll see what we can do to help you, you know, go up, you know, get your medical benefits or whatever. I'm willing to help, willing to work with you. You know, the next thing you know, you get slapped in the face. They just don't show up. They end up drunk. And, you know, you can try so hard, but only if a person's willing. And that's what we have to do. Look for those people that are willing. And if they are willing to do it, they're going to set an example. And once someone turns around and sees them, that they are now an example, they're going, hey, wait a minute. Joe can do it. I can do it. And then you start that avalanche. And then we reverse the cycle. But we got to start one person.
Yep. Absolutely. Very well put.
Well, our call lines are open. If you want to call in, it's 917-889-6675. We still do have the dedication to do. I don't know if you want to take a break and then go into the dedication or not, Mike.
Well, actually, Annie, if I could play a clip, I uploaded that clip instead of doing like a play this clip and take a break, and then we'll come back and do the dedication. As we talked about at the top of the hour, I think one of the best senators we've ever elected, although he's very early. I just think he is a terrific person, and I know Annie concurs. Rand Paul and Justin Amash. Tim Hooskamp also agrees. Ted Cruz. Here he is.
Senator from Texas.
Madam President, the senior senator from Arizona.
urge this body to trust the Republicans. Let me be clear, I don't trust the Republicans. And I don't trust the Democrats. And I think a whole lot of Americans likewise don't trust the Republicans and the Democrats, because it is leadership in both parties that has gotten us in this mess. You know, my wife and I have two little girls at home. They're 5 and 2. When Caroline was born, our national debt was $10 trillion. Today, it's nearly $17 trillion. In her short 5 years of life, the national debt has grown by over 60%. Madam President, what we are doing to our kids and grandkids, I think, is immoral. Now, I commend the Democrats in this body for their candor. The Democrats and President Obama have been very explicit that it is their intention to raise the debt ceiling and to do so with no conditions whatsoever, just to keep borrowing and borrowing and borrowing money without any structural reforms to fix the problems. That is an intellectually consistent position. I think it is a dangerous position, but it is at least candid. And that is the reason why every day for 60 days the Democrats have opposed taking the debt ceiling off the table in this discussion. But unfortunately, one of the reasons we got into this mess is because a lot of Republicans were complicit in this spending spree. And that's why so many Americans are disgusted with both sides of this House, because we need leaders on both sides to do, as my friend from Virginia said, to roll up our sleeves, to compromise, to work together and fix the problem, fix the enormous fiscal and economic problems, stop bankrupting our country. What this issue is all about is very simple. Will we allow the debt ceiling to be raised in an unlimited amount with just a 50-vote threshold? And if the answer to that is yes, we have in effect just voted to raise the debt ceiling, because the Democrats hold a majority of this body, 55 seats, and the Democrats are explicit, they want to raise the debt ceiling.
Well, there you have it. Basically, nobody tells it better right there. And
absolutely. I mean,
Annie, I got a quick question. Go ahead, Annie.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, he opened it up with basically making a sarcastic remark about the senior senator from Arizona. I wonder who he was referring to. My mind is drawing a blank. What douchebag is the senior senator from Arizona?
Well, ask our caller, area code 816. You're on the air live with Southern Sense. I'm Annie. Who are you speaking to?
Annie, if you don't memorize my number by now.
Scott, am I going to memorize the number of every single person that calls in? I can't. So, Thomas, who's the douchebag from Arizona, the senior senator?
Which one, John McCain or the other one?
No, John McCain is the one we're talking. I don't know the other
bing,
one.
Bing, 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 you get the $50 question.
Did I miss Niger Ennis?
Yes, you did.
He just hung up just maybe about 2 minutes ago here, but you can catch in the podcast. And people know that even though we were not a featured host today, featured show today, we are going to be featured tomorrow, so they're going to replay our show tomorrow. So I hope you join in tomorrow. And, oh, by the way, I've got to say a bunch of shout-outs and loads to some people. I don't know if anyone out there listening has ever heard of the Tea Party community. If you're on Facebook and you're getting frustrated with the stuff that's going on in Facebook, getting blocked on certain aspects, or if you have an in that you want to sign someone and you're getting blocked, a lot of people are migrating off of Facebook. And there's a new one out there called teapartycommunity.com. Now, I joined them only 2 months ago and had about 100,000. They now have close to 125,000 in the last 2 months. In 2 months, I've had over 1,300 people that followed me over and joined. So I've got to say hello to Marianne Newell, who is listening in as she cleans the house. Michael O'Brien, he's a partial payday, so he's going to try to catch the broadcast. Karen Phillips, she's going to be trying to join. And let's see, who's the other one? Tom Egan. Hopefully Tom Egan is listening in. Maybe he'll want to call in. So to my new friends in the Tea Party community, thank you for rocking and rolling with us.
Hey, Annie, you got a growing fan club.
Oh, I got to tell you also, Tea Party community may actually take me on as part of their staff. We're working with something that we may do with the show, Mike. So we may end up expanding the show, and you necessarily have to, you know, worry about co-hosting. I don't know what we're doing yet, but we're going to talk about it next week. So maybe doing something with the show with Tea Party community.
What she's basically saying, Thomas, is that, Mike, your days are about numbered because she's bringing in some new blood around this joint. All righty, let's let the visible conservative Thomas, who I believe has a show this evening, talk. Well, go ahead, Thomas.
Oh, yeah. This is going to catch you guys' interest really big. You know, Annie, I'm not as big of a superstar as you are because you can get all the good people. But we just kind of managed to finagle the U.S. Congressman who broke the story about the IRS targeting the Iowa pro-life group. He's going to be on our show tonight along with the representative of the Iowa Pro-Life Coalition, and they are going to talk about exactly how they were targeted by the IRS.
Wow. You know, this whole story is – I'm sorry, Annie, you went in and out. Did you say
– No, I did just say I was – I'm privy to a lot of the stuff that was in the thick of that. You know, as I said earlier, some friends of mine, Myrtle Beach Tea Party, Somerville 912, the South Carolina Tea Party Conference, Coalition. I knew a lot of what was going on at the time. And again, one of the reasons why we chose not to be a 501c4, you know, God bless them for standing up. But I also say that I still feel you were right to avoid that entanglement. There's people that can fight that battle, that have the funds and everything else can fight that. That's what's happening. They have the funds, had the manpower. We didn't. But we were still able to get our message across because now we were free to move where they could not move. So there's two sides to the coin. So, you know, in a way, they did us a favor doing what they did. We just had it back and let it blow up on them, which is what we did.
For those who are listening and heard what Annie just said, Thomas, spread the word, especially tomorrow since we're featured and we'll have some additional downloads in the archives. For those who watched the IRS hearings, the two people who stood up interrupted the loudmouth, those were Annie's friends, especially the lady in the dress. So, Homeland, if you're coming to anyone, go to Annie, not to me, because I don't know who these people are. But Annie knows these people personally, Thomas, especially the lady.
That gave the standing ovation. Yeah.
We're going to have the Ubulus party, because I'll tell you, Annie, you're everywhere. You're like underneath the – just like the old Get Smart, underneath the toilet seat, you open a cupboard. Those were Annie's friends. Well, what next? You're going to see someone slap the president. It's going to be like Annie's mom or somebody. Oh.
Yeah.
We are approaching top of the hour. Do we want to do our dedication before we go into the second half of the show?
Yeah, we're going to do the dedication now. Anyone that listens to the shows, we do dedicate each show to a fallen hero. And normally it's done at the very beginning of the show, then we bring our guest on. But time constraints prevent us from doing that. So you will give us a moment of silence and honor those. Plus, I want to remind you that this is Memorial Day weekend. So we want to honor just not this one fallen hero, but all fallen heroes that have given everything for our freedoms and liberties, so that this nation may remain strong. So, Mike, if you'll pull up the army hymn.
It's playing.
Okay. This is from the Rocky Mountain Telegram. To the people who knew U.S. Army Sergeant Rayvon Battle Jr., the 25-year-old Rocky Mountain neighbor truly embodied the characteristics of a hero. Rayvon had many roles, but the biggest he had was the role of a hero, an American hero. He wasn't some superficial figure like Rambo or John Wayne that leaves the set at the end of the day. No, was he some superhero who Hollywood has brought to life, retired U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Larry Turner said. Battle was a real man, a real hero, one that faced adversity and danger like so many other heroes before him. A member of the East End Baptist Church, Battle graduated in 2005 from Northern Nash High School, joined the U.S. Army on August 30th, the same year. At Fort Lewis, Washington, Battle rose to squad leader of the 38th Engineer Company, a Stryker Brigade Combat 2nd Infantry Division. While Rayvon had a small stature, he had a big heart. He had a large determination to be best he could, Turner said. Known as Junior to his friends and family, Battle was twice in Iraq, once in May 2008 and again in February 2012. Battle went on with advanced individual training and became a 21 Bravo for combat. He wasn't sitting in the back handing out supplies and serving meals. Not that there is anything wrong with that. He was on the front line, clearing lines and defusing bombs and booby traps. Roughly 3 weeks after the war was in October, combat engineer aid. Gracious applause erupted throughout the church, along with a standing ovation when he turned past the audience, thank a true American hero. When a Battle stepped through the side, went into the military right at a high school with Battle. We were paired together as roommates. It was the first time living away from our families for both of us. We bonded instantly, Guy said. Battle when I met him. He had to and all the service. Like I said, hold back a fun tag. With that, a while. But this is like our you're pretty close and brave on the second of my work. So, anyway, I knew I could trust within. Staff Sergeant Rayvon Battle felt that he brought down to the Army in the middle to become a man. By all accounts, he had succeeded before he was killed November 13, 2012. Crime. Sergeant Battle lost his life fighting alongside his fellow squad leader's brothers while attempting to stem an impending explosion of epic proportions, Mason wrote in a tribute to the Army sanctioned Facebook site. Sergeant Battle made a conscious choice to live by a code of ethics and a code of conduct, and he exemplified the perspective that I and many others admired and respected. According to the Army, Battle earned awards and decorations, including the Army Commendation Medal, the Army Achievement Medal with the Second Oak Leaf Cluster, both in accounts of his people in Rocky Mount and from those who served alongside him thousands of miles away. Battle emerged as a leader, regardless of acclaim. He is remembered as someone who would do the right thing, no matter how difficult, as a result of upbringing and training. Sergeant Battle, one of those not rare, non-commissioned officers, just shine. A tremendous leader with an interesting ability to perform magnanimously under pressure. His grandmother put it more simply. Junior was a hero at whatever he did. Echoes from a gun salute and the somber sounds of taps hung in the air in the garden at the cemetery where U.S. pallbearers took Battle to his final in place. I was very surprised to come to people in honor of my son's sacrifice, Rayvon Sebastian said. He made a great sacrifice. He is a hero, and a hero deserves great honor. And all men and women, this Memorial Day, we give out the song, My Name is America, and we say thank you. We honor you.
I fought for my liberty. I paid with the blood of my people. Freedom has never been free. Now my door's always open to dreamers and friends. But when I'm attacked, I protect and defend. I stand for my respect for humanity. Now I'm challenged by tyrants who envy my power, but their vicious deeds become my finest hour. Because my name is America, I stand for.
Always mute down my mic. I don't think anyone wanted to hear me singing.
Great song, great dedication to Rivon Battle, and as always, great tribute on this Memorial Day weekend to all of those who have fallen, that we just day in and day out almost forget are there.
Yeah, and you know, I got to tell a little bit of a funny story. You know, I had met Todd Allen Herndon, and he had been up in Myrtle Beach, and he was giving a concert right there in the front row with my husband, and he comes up to sing this song, and I'm sitting there and staring at me. Well, I'm singing along with as loud as I can, and my arms are waving, pointing, you know me when I get involved, and my heart was really in it. He's just smiling, and he was having fun watching me have fun. And that's how I got all these autographed CDs, and we got one more to raffle off, and that's going to be coming up real soon. So, me, Spotlight.
Of course.
Hey,
but Thomas, I think Annie is what we call a diva.
Listen, I'm going to throw a couple things out here, and one of these things I want to throw out, I don't know if anyone is aware of this, but 40 years ago today, 571 Vietnam POWs were in the White House for a presidential dinner in their honor. 1,300 people attended, the largest gala ever at that time at the White House, to honor these 571 veterans. It's 40 years ago today. My question is, today, what's President Obama doing? Instead of President Obama doing anything at the Nixon Library, the remaining POWs, 200 of them, are meeting for a two-day event. Mr. Obama, why have you forgotten these men? We have not. And every day we remember every single one of these men and women. Memorial Day is not just this weekend. For me and others, it's every day in our hearts. So it's 40 days ago, 40 years ago. I've got a clip here. Let me see if I can pull them up. Bear with me for a second. This is one of the POWs, Lieutenant Denton Jr. He was being interviewed on camera by one of his tormentors, and they were trying to use this as propaganda to the world. Now, I want you to listen to the questions. While he is answering the questions, he is blinking his eyes, and the word he is blinking as he is answering the questions as calm as he can was the word torture. So when the Vietnamese broadcast this, that they had a group of propaganda, instead the world found out that our POWs were being tortured. This is from the Hanoi Hilton. Here we go.
I get adequate food and adequate clothing and medical care when I require it.
How do you think about the so-called Vietnamese law? Do you think that's friendly about it?
No, I don't know what is happening, but whatever the position of my government is, I support it fully.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever the position of my government is, I believe in it. Yes, sir. I am a member of that government.
3 years ago, this man sits down at dinner with President Nixon. Now, this is President Nixon's toast, 1973, May 24th, to these brave men and women.
Between President Nixon and General Flynn, the senior member of the former president.
It was always the custom at dinner at the White House to have a toast to the honored guest. The difficulty tonight is that there are so many honored guests that we would be drinking all night and into the day. Somebody just said, what's wrong with that? But tonight, as I was thinking of the toast to propose, before doing so, I would like all of us to join, I think, in a round of applause for the marvelous White House staff and all these service organizations that have put this dinner on. now to come to the moment of the toast, I think you would be interested to know the advice I got from some of the senior officers when I asked them how the toast should be proposed. And to a man, each one of them said, "Do not propose it to us. We have been toasted and we appreciate the great welcome that we have received." And most of them referred to the missing in action, to those who have been killed in action, to those who have served in Vietnam, to those who are serving today all over the world, to those who wear the uniform of the United States proudly, as they have worn it so proudly. And, of course, I could go on and on about the men that these strong men and stout-hearted men would like for us to recognize. I think there is one group, and I will not propose the toast to them tonight because I have another group that I think deserves that accolade, but one group that I would like to mention particularly. The most difficult decision that I have made since being president was on December the 18th of last year. And there were many occasions in that 10-day period after the decision was made when I wondered whether anyone in this country really supported it. But I can tell you this, after having met each one of our honored guests this evening, after having talked to them, I think that all of us would like to join in a round of applause for the brave men that took those B-52s in and did the job. Because as all of you know, if they hadn't have done it, you wouldn't be here tonight. And now, I do come to the moment and I propose the toast. It is traditional on occasion to propose the toast to a lady rather than to a man. And on this occasion, I think of a first lady, and of many first ladies. Of course, traditionally, the wife of the president is the first lady of this country. I can tell you, as I look back over those months and years that we have met with the wives and the mothers of those of you who were prisoners of war, they were and are the bravest, most magnificent women I have ever met in my life. If they will give me my official toasting glass, I will propose the toast. If all the gentlemen will please rise. Tonight, as President of the United States, I designate every one of the women here, the wives, the mothers, and others who are guests of our POWs as First Ladies. Gentlemen, to the First Ladies of America, the First Ladies. Now to respond to the toast, we will call on the ranking officer, and as I recall, he was a colonel the last time I met him, so we will call him a colonel at the moment, but before he gets through, he's going to be a lot higher than that. Between President Nixon and...
Sorry about that.
was December 18, 1972. Richard Nixon ordered the B-52s to bomb crap out of Hanoi. He basically sent them a message. You either release all of our prisoner of war you're holding there, or we're going to continue until you have no city left. Those men were here on that day, and 200 this weekend have been honored at the Richard Nixon Library. One last thing before we move on. This is John Wayne's address to the POWs upon his return. I think he spoke for all of us. God bless this man. Sorry about a little interruption here.
Beautiful boy. Beautiful boy. All these people that are appearing here tonight went to Vietnam. I've been advised to say that if you didn't know it. I want you to a real American right here that did a sensational job in Vietnam, shaking hands, and he's done a great job. He's a great citizen in every category, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Wayne, right here.
President, ladies and gentlemen, I guess I feel like all Americans tonight were sorry that about 40,000 of your comrades at arms can't be here. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I think this is a great country. It's a lot better off with you fellas back here. I think it was wonderful of the president to bring us all together like this tonight. I'm happy all you fellows and your families could get here to be with him. I feel pretty good that he has this chance to meet you all, because you all have a lot in common. You hung in there when the going was rough. So did he. Stuck by your guns. You stuck by your guns, and so did he. You love this blessed country, and so does he, and so do all of us. You men, I want to say thanks for showing the whole world the kind of men a free country can put up when the going gets rough. You're the best we have, and I'll ride off into the sunset with you anytime.
Now, wasn't that fantastic? He was actually crying when he made that delivery.
Well, you can tell he was choked up. That was beautiful. I mean, even the ending. You know, John Wayne himself obviously is a veteran.
Yes.
Just a terrific. That piece was so terrific. And you know what's best about it, Annie, is Vietnam in so many ways is just forgotten. And 40 years later of that anniversary date, here you are playing it. That's just terrific, because so many of those people in that war were just, of all wars we've been in, that is the black eye of this country, the way we treated many of the returners, just everything about that war.
And it's not just when they returned, it's afterwards, and they went and sought medical treatment. The VA treated them like crap. There's still men looking for treatments from Agent Orange. I've lost friend after friend from diseases that they caught all over there, whether it was Agent Orange or malaria or, God, I mean, I can't tell you. I wasn't age-wise to go into the war. Obviously, I was still in high school when it ended. My older brother just missed the draft by one number, and we did a dedication to Yanni's friend, who he called his twin, who was killed there by friendly fire. And
no one's really teaching that history, and I don't want anyone to forget it, and that's why I felt it was important that we said this on today's show. And I want everyone, when they go home this weekend, while they're at the barbecues, their picnics, playing with the kids and nephews, or just on the beach or on the boat or whatever you're doing, look around. Take a good look around and look at the freedom that you enjoy that no other nation on the world enjoys. And the only reason why you have that freedom is because someone was willing to stand up and to fight for it. And all I ask is you say a silent prayer of thank you to them. And if you know a vet, you know someone serving the military, walk up, shake their hand, and thank you. Because we owe them everything. I owe them everything. Okay, now you got me clear.
Sure.
All right.
Well, that's just well put. I wanna quickly. I know we only have a couple of minutes. I just want to play a quick Andrew Napolitano moment, which is great. I'll cut it in just a minute, but it's oh, nobody does it like the judge.
Again, breaking news has come in recently. Fox News has now confirmed President Obama will name a White House budget official as acting IRS commissioner. His name is Daniel Werfel. He worked in the.
You know what? Let's just play our tribute song. That can be better. We'll play this another time, since it is Memorial Day weekend, and I think the song, our song, is more of a tribute than we can. We know what the judge is going to say. So, wow. With that being said and done, my friends, I think Annie is probably blubbering back there, which is what we should do. Many of these people who left his young men never returned. Some returned with missing arms and legs. Some returned physically in great health, but between the ears, totally forgotten, totally confused, totally lost.
I want to remind you that...
go ahead, Ann.
Remind you that when we come back on Tuesday, we're going to follow up with this vein of our veterans and our troops, because our guest will be Nicole Starr Johnson, who was the founder of the PTSD retreat, the post-traumatic stress disorder retreat, which she fought back in 2010 and has had fantastic success with these veterans returning with PTSD. So join us back here on Tuesday and help us. She was trying to do a retreat, which she couldn't, but she did not have enough funds. So ask your friends to join us on Tuesday, even if it's a dollar. Join, listen. Oh, God bless. See, you told the truth. Listen in and give Nicole Starr your ear. Until then, we must say good night. God bless. Have a safe, happy, healthy weekend. And remember this Memorial Day, today and every day. I leave you with I Am America by Krista Branch. Good night.
Happy Memorial Day.